won an upset victory over Britain. Those were the days when many living Britons could still remember that Australia had been a prison colony until the 1860s, which made the defeat a particularly galling experience. A newspaper reporter joked that British cricket had died, that the body would be cremated, and that the ashes would be taken to Australia. The captain of an English team visiting Australia later that year swore that he would bring the ashes home again. His team won, and a group of Australian women, one of whom he later married, presented him with a little red urn. It's become the single most famous cricketing relic in the world. England and Australia still play each other regularly. The contest is always referred to as the Ashes Series. But even when Australia wins, the actual urn and its contents stay at Lord's. You can see it there in the MCC Museum. One of the many curious aspects of cricket is that, for more than a century, many of the best players wanted not to be paid. In most international sports today, one sign of a great player is his huge salary. But the amateur spirit was strong among British gentlemen throughout the Victorian era and the early 20th century. The great thing was to play brilliantly for sheer love of the game and with no ulterior financial motive. Where Major League Baseball has its annual All-Star Game, cricket, for many decades, had an event called the Gentlemen versus the Players match, which was usually played at Lord's. The best professional cricketers, men who'd started life in the working class and could only manage to play if paid to do so, went head-to-head against the best of the amateurs, the gentlemen. The players usually won, but not always, especially in the late 1800s, when a superb amateur named W.G. Grace from Gloucestershire energized the gentlemen and led them to several victories. For some players, incidentally, their greatest hope was to eventually reach a position in which they could afford to no longer be paid for playing, at which point they became gentlemen cricketers instead. Let me digress here for a moment to comment on the term amateur, which carries opposite implications in Britain and America. In Britain, to say that someone is an amateur is high praise, because it indicates that his actions are unmotivated by pecuniary gain. In the United States, on the other hand, to say that someone is amateurish implies that he scarcely knows what he's doing and is likely to make a mess of it. If you're visiting England in the summer, try to visit a cricket match. International matches are called test matches, and the nations that play are those that formerly belonged to the British Empire, including Australia, New Zealand, India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, South Africa, and the West Indies. They are five-day affairs, but it's a lot of fun to go for just one of those days, just as it's fun to attend one of the 4 days of a golfing major. The venues are Lord's, or another ground in London called the Oval, Trent Bridge in Nottingham, Headingley in Leeds, Old Trafford in Manchester, and Edgbaston in Birmingham. Easier to understand, and flashier too, are 2020 games confined to one afternoon in which you can see the whole thing from start to finish, and in which aggression and daring leads to risky play and big rewards. Cricket is stressful for the players, but it's relaxing for you to be in the audience, especially on a warm day when the play just rolls along, with one team or another gradually developing an advantage and a few individuals standing out among all the rest. Occasional moments of drama punctuate the calm, such as when a batsman hits the ball out of the playing area without it touching the ground. In baseball, that's a home run and it scores one, but in cricket, it scores six. Even if you can't get to a test match, you'll see every summer weekend in parks and on village greens, groups of enthusiasts, all clad in white, playing at every level of skill. English literature is drenched with evocations of cricket. It's a kind of stand-in for instant nostalgia. On the other hand, if you're visiting Britain any time between late August and early May, go to a soccer match. And remember that in Britain the game is called football. There are about 100 professional teams in a hierarchy of leagues, at the top of which is the Premier League, containing the 20 best teams in England and Wales. Scotland has a league of its own. Many of the best players in the world belong to Premier League clubs, and it's common for a team based in London or Manchester to include players from Brazil and Argentina, Spain, Russia, Nigeria, and Italy. A demanding schedule and a long season keep them in phenomenally good condition, and the level of play is extremely high. A match consists of two uninterrupted 45-minute halves, and there are none of the tedious commercial interruptions that have degraded and disfigured American pro football. My own team, when I was a teenager, was Derby County, which had a few good years in the early 1970s. But I have to admit that it's not been the most illustrious of the British teams over the long haul. That honour would have to go to Manchester United, which has been the British champion a record 20 times and has won all the other honours in British and European competitions at least once and often much more than once. Nicknamed the Red Devils, Manchester United play in red shirts and white shorts. They've had their share of hard knocks. Their stadium was twice bombed by the German Air Force during World War II, and for a while, United had to suffer the indignity of sharing with their bitter local rival, Manchester City, who drove a hard bargain on the rent. United suffered a much worse and more traumatic blow in 1958, when a plane carrying them back from a game against Red Star Belgrade in Yugoslavia crashed in Germany, killing 23 people, including 8 of the team's best players, and injuring their manager, Matt Busby. Man United has also been the club team of many internationally famous players. Just about everyone in the English-speaking world has heard of David Beckham. He played for Manchester United from 1992 to 2003, and was awarded an OBE, the Order of the British Empire. Bend It Like Beckham was a popular movie from 2002 when he was at the height of his fame. Even for people not interested in football, his marriage to one of the Spice Girls caused a sensation. I recall being in Myanmar in 2015, one of the remotest and least westernized countries in the world, with what is to me a completely incomprehensible form of writing. Even there, however, newsstands carried magazines devoted to the Premier League, and above all, to Manchester United. It's probably the single most famous sports franchise in the world. Since 1910, Manchester United have occupied a ground named Old Trafford. They moved from their original stadium because it was on swampy ground and adjacent to factories that spewed out toxic smoke. Success in the early 20th century enabled them to move up in the world. Old Trafford was pretty basic. It held 80,000 fans, most of them standing on terraced steps with just a few seats at one end. That was standard practice throughout Britain. Football was the ultimate in cheap working-class entertainment, and most fans didn't expect to sit down to watch the game. Standing crowds surged up and down the terraces, chanting and sometimes fighting in great gangs against fans from rival teams. It was exhilarating, rough, and sometimes dangerous. Police mounted on horses with riot shields worked at crowd control outside the stadiums and tried to keep rival gangs apart. In 1989, at an important match in Sheffield between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest, 96 people were crushed to death and more than 750 injured. A government report into this, the Hillsborough disaster, prompted a requirement that all fans should be seated, with the result that stadium capacities went down. The seats were anything but luxurious, usually just hard wooden or moulded plastic benches, but they made the stadiums a great deal safer. It was no longer possible to keep on cramming people into a place that was already full. Old Trafford's capacity shrank. The stadium has been extended several times since then, however, and now has a capacity of more than 75,000. Anyway, think ahead. If you want to attend a game at Old Trafford, you'll need to book in advance. And you'll discover that, at least with the elite Premier League teams, the cheap and cheerful days are long gone. On the other hand, you won't find it too difficult to get a ticket to see Derby County at their stadium, Pride Park, even 5 minutes before kick-off. There's a special atmosphere at football matches that was brilliantly captured by the novelist Nick Hornby in his 1992 book, Fever Pitch. Hornby, a lifelong fan of Arsenal, an elite team from London, evokes the glum pessimism of hardened fans who know that, in the long run, defeat is more likely than victory. And you see, the actual players who come and go every few seasons as less important to their team's identity than the lifelong fans. Working-class culture is much harder to identify than it used to be in the days when George Orwell wrote The Road to Wigan Pier. But you can still see what's left of it in the pubs around northern football stadiums and in the stands themselves every winter Saturday afternoon. The mood is very different from the decorum and restraint of cricket audiences. Rugby branched off from football in the early 19th century. We have countless ancient and medieval accounts of games in which large mobs of men kicked and threw balls towards goals. Rugby School in the English Midlands county of Warwickshire innovated in the 1820s by permitting the player holding the ball to run with it, where previously he'd been required to stand still until he passed it to someone else. The ball was oval rather than round because it was an inflated pig's bladder, later encased in leather but retaining the same shape. Thomas Arnold, the influential headmaster of rugby in the 1830s, inspired a generation of boarding school leaders to use their institutions in the nurture of Christian gentlemen. Arnold didn't particularly care for sports, but he saw them as a useful alternative to letting the boys fight with local lads or go poaching on the nearby farms. Two distinct branches of rugby developed in the late 19th century. Rugby League, most popular in the working class north, and rugby union, with strongholds further south and higher up the social ladder. Rugby union was strictly amateurs only until as recently as 1995. Both versions have large, loyal followings and boisterous crowds every winter weekend, though rugby union carries a hint of greater decorum. If you'd like to see a rugby match, the iconic stadium is at Twickenham in West London. Twickenham is to rugby union what Lord's is to cricket. Different again and much more well-mannered is the All England Lawn Tennis and Croquet Club at Wimbledon, only about 5 miles from Twickenham. Tennis has medieval origins. Shakespeare's Henry V, set in 1415 and based on real events, depicts the young king receiving a box of tennis balls as a gift from the French king. He regards it as an insult and decides he'll react by invading France. But these balls were from the game we now call real or royal tennis, played in a complicated indoor court, quite different from the game that's played on grass at Wimbledon. Our modern game is officially called lawn tennis, but its inventor, Major Walter Wingfield, called it Sphäristiki. That was in 1873, and it shows that the game was so good on its merits, it could even overcome the burden of an almost unpronounceable name. Sphäristiki is the Greek word for playing with a ball. The MCC, the Marylebone Cricket Club, of Lord's fame, already a venerable institution by the 1870s, once again played an important role by writing out standardised lawn tennis rules in 1875. Lawn tennis depended on new technologies. The recent invention of vulcanised rubber made it possible to produce bouncy balls, while the invention of lawn mowers made it possible to cultivate a fast and even playing surface rather than the bumpy sheep-grazed meadows of earlier times. Wimbledon, the club, had been founded in 1868, a few years before Major Wingfield's invention, which sounds surprising, but at first it was dedicated to croquet. Read Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, also from the 1860s, for a hallucinatory version of croquet. It's a game that requires players to hit balls through hoops with mallets, and it blends the illusion of gentility with the reality of malice. To be a good player, you need to be merciless. For Alice, it's made all the more difficult because her ball is a spiky hedgehog and her mallet is a living flamingo. Anyway, Wimbledon was still a distinct village west of London, rather than the suburb it is today, when the club was first established. In 1877, for the first time, it held a lawn tennis tournament, open to anyone who could pay the entry fee, and it attracted 22 players. The first ladies' tournament was held in 1884, though the ladies were offered no concessions in the matter of dress, and were expected to wear high-necked, long-sleeved and full-length dresses. For the first 30 years, the reigning champion in the men's and women's tournaments played only once in the final against whoever had battled his or her way through the elimination rounds. The club moved to its current site at the start of the 1920s, building the complex of courts that's familiar today, though on a much smaller scale at first. The King and Queen opened the new facility in 1922, and that year, for the first time, the reigning champion had to start again from the beginning of the tournament. Amateurism was the rule, as in cricket, and tennis had a self-consciously elitist flavour. When Fred Perry won the men's singles competition in 1934, the first Englishman to manage it since 1909, the snooty club members deplored the fact that their champion was the son of a northern cotton factory worker. Perry won 3 years in a row, 1934, 35, and 36, but then horrified the snobbish members of the All England Club by turning professional and emigrating to the United States. Only half a century after his first Wimbledon championship in 1984 did the club finally get round to setting up a statue of him. Competition was suspended during World War II. The courts were ploughed up to help alleviate severe food shortages, and Centre Court itself, like Old Trafford, suffered a direct hit from a German bomb. Its fortunes revived with the return of peace, and it has remained, up to the present, the most prestigious tennis centre in the world and home of the most coveted awards. Even if you're not able to attend the championship in July, there are year-round tours of the iconic facilities, including a visit to the Wimbledon Lawn Tennis Museum, which holds an unparalleled collection of tennis memorabilia. Of all the popular ball sports, golf may be the oddest. Unlike the others, each player has a ball of his or her own, which no one else is allowed to hit. Unlike the others, the ball is always hit while stationary. It sounds almost comically easy. Tell that to anyone who's sweated and fumed around a difficult course, where even the force of gravity starts to seem malignant, or where the ball always slices, hooks, or ends up in unplayable rough. Golf knows how to mess with your mind and how to tease and taunt you by just occasionally letting you make a shot that's so good you can't resist coming back for more. In my case, these shots often happen right near the end of a round, such that my resolve to quit forever after three putting on the 16th green is completely forgotten after my chip shot out of the rough to within a foot of the hole on the 18th. It's difficult to pick a definite date for the beginning of golf, as it is for cricket. It developed in the medieval Netherlands out of a variety of earlier stick and ball games. In Dutch, the word for club is kolf, which sounds very much like golf. The game is first mentioned in Scotland in an edict of 1457, in which the king forbids it, because it distracts men from the exercise they should be doing, archery. Of course, he wouldn't have had to ban it unless someone was playing it, So we can be confident that a recognisable form of golf was already in use by then. The fact that the ban was repeated in many subsequent edicts shows that golfers ignored or defied it. We know from other evidence that the game was already well established at St Andrews. The earliest set of rules we possess were written in 1744 in Edinburgh, by which time a handful of men were playing in England too. This was also the date of the first recorded tournament. It was won by an Edinburgh surgeon named John Rattray. Early equipment was terrible by our standards. Balls were made of leather stuffed tight with boiled feathers and then hammered to get them as round as possible, after which they were painted. They were called featheries and had severe limitations. For one thing, they got heavier in wet weather, which changed their flight. Second, a clumsy stroke could slice them open, and they were costly. Skilled craftsmen could only make 3 or 4 in a day. Early players made do with just one club, the shaft and head of which were all made of wood. Dr. Robert Adams Patterson made the much-improved gutta-percha ball, or gutty, in the 1840s, and it quickly displaced the feathery. Gutta-percha is the resin from a Malayan tree that softens when warmed, can be shaped, and then hardens again. It was a predecessor to plastic, used for knife handles, piano keys, walking sticks, and memorably as insulation around marine cables that carried telegraph wires across the English Channel, then across the Atlantic Ocean. Smooth gutta-percha golf balls flew further and truer than featheries, and players noticed a curious thing, that they were better at the end of a round than at the beginning. This was because the little dents, cuts and grooves they acquired after many hits made them more aerodynamic. At that point, the makers created moulds so that gutties could be made with the dimples right from the outset. By 1880, they were comparable to the balls we use today, though not yet as precise in flight or capacity for spin. Improvements in clubs as well as balls, starting around 1880, led to a rapid rise in golf's popularity. In 1880, there were still only 12 golf clubs in England, but by 1914, there were more than 1,000. St Andrews in eastern Scotland, which lays claim to being the ancestral home of the sport, gave rise to the tradition of playing 18 holes. In the 1700s, there were 11, or possibly 12, stretching in a line along the hummocky sandhills, or links, between the sea and terra firma. Rounds of golf consisted of playing all of them on the way out, and then all of them again on the way back to the clubhouse. When a few of the holes were consolidated, being considered too short, 9 were left, which, when played twice, made 18. The Royal and Ancient Golf Club of St Andrews was formed in 1754 and became the ruling body of British golf. In those days, and well into the 1800s, the links were also used for raising rabbits, grazing cows, and even spreading out laundry to dry. One St Andrews rule from 1851 states, "When a ball is on clothes or within a club length of a washing tub, the clothes may be drawn from under the ball and the tub may be removed." The Open Tournament, oldest of the four majors in professional golf, was founded in 1860 at Prestwick and played for the first time at St Andrews in 1873. It's always on a links course with challenging areas of rough ground, much less manicured than the sites of the major American tournaments. St Andrews is a beautiful old medieval town, well worth a visit, even if you're not interested in golf. The ruins of a medieval abbey dominate the town, whose other buildings, including the university and the golf club's headquarters, are mainly Georgian and Victorian. The clubhouse of the Royal and Ancient itself was built in 1854, with plenty of ceremonial and a prayer that God would look down from heaven to bless it. Today, just across from the clubhouse, you'll find the British Golf Museum, which, like the museum at Wimbledon, is a fascinating destination in its own right. It holds a collection of more than 17,000 items, some of which are hundreds of years old. If you dream of playing the famed old course at St Andrews, the great thing is, you can actually do it. And not just the old course, but the other six public courses maintained by the St Andrews Links Trust. You need to plan ahead to get a tee time, but it can be done. Playing the old course isn't cheap, but it's competitive with the best American courses. And to anyone who loves not just the game, but its traditions and heritage, an irreplaceable and unforgettable experience. Britain is as sports mad as America, with football dominating men's winter conversation, while tennis, cricket and golf take over every summer. As British people have become more health conscious in recent decades, more of them than ever before have become participants too, with leagues and clubs catering to every taste throughout England, Scotland and Wales. You'll find abundant evidence of this reality whenever you find yourself in Britain.
Lecture 36, How to Think About Visiting Britain.
One of the many advantages in living now, rather than at almost any other time in the past, is how much easier and safer it is to see other parts of the world. Throughout most of world history, the idea of travelling for pleasure would have been almost unimaginable. It was far too dangerous, too expensive, and too unpleasant. Travel, in most ages, has been confined to a tiny minority, and the traveller's motives were usually trade, pilgrimage, or conquest. Now, by contrast, most people in the English-speaking world can afford to travel for pleasure, at least occasionally, and have immense opportunities to do so. If you've never been abroad before, Britain's the ideal place to go first. There's no language problem, apart from a few minor issues of dialect and idiom. The climate is mild, never too hot or too cold. The place is safe, so long as you take simple safety precautions. And the police are helpful rather than intimidating. It's also a country full of fascinating places, in which distances are relatively short, with plenty of convenient ways of travelling. And, of course, the family tree for many Americans, Canadians and Australians has its roots in British soil. Those are all good reasons to make it your destination. Strangely, some people don't like the idea that they are tourists. Haven't we all heard friends complaining about all the obnoxious tourists they found clogging up Stratford, Stonehenge and Canterbury Cathedral? Even though others could have said the same about them. The best way to avoid that problem is to visit less crowded places, where you won't be part of a great multitude. It's easy to do, because, as I hope I've demonstrated throughout this series, there are so many less well-known places deserving of your time. Tourism is a good test of self-knowledge. Ask yourself why you want to travel. For most people, that's easy enough. They've heard about and seen pictures of the most interesting places in other countries and would like the chance to see them for themselves. Or else they have particular interests that lead them to travel. But isn't it true that we sometimes show internal contradictions? We want to have adventures, but we also want to be safe. We don't mind roughing it, so long as we're comfortable. We want to find a part of the world where everything's different, so long as the food's not too odd and there's plenty of ice for cold drinks. This is another reason for testing your degree of adventurousness with a trip to Britain, which is different, but not too different, from the world you already inhabit. Think carefully about when you want to visit. The obvious answer in Britain is during the summer, when you're more likely to get good weather. Britain is a long way north of the equator, which means that there's a huge difference between the amount of daylight on the longest and shortest days of the year. This variation is most striking in Scotland, where the stingy winter days seem terribly brief, but where the almost endless summer days give you a sense of energy and optimism. The problem with summer is that the rest of the world is on the move, especially in the second half of July and all of August, which are the British school holiday months. If you can visit in May, June or September, you're likely to see the gardens blooming and get the best of everything without the burden of too much company. It's also worth thinking about how to time your arrival at the most popular sites, where queues even to get in can be discouraging. On my most recent visit to Windsor Castle, I started at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, by which time the massive crowds of earlier in the day had dwindled, and it was easy to see everything without clamour or bustle before it closed at 5:30. Depending on your particular interests, you might make a point of visiting to coincide with major annual events. These include Crufts, the annual dog show, which takes place in March every year at the National Exhibition Centre in Birmingham. Royal Ascot is an event in both the horse racing calendar and the fashion year, when ladies vie with one another by appearing in elaborate and daring hats and dresses. It takes place in mid-June over a long weekend. For motor racing fans, the British Grand Prix takes place in mid-July at Silverstone on the border of Buckinghamshire and Northamptonshire. The circuit is on the site of an old Royal Air Force bomber airfield. The guard is changed at Buckingham Palace every day during the summer and on odd days during the winter. But if you want a fuller display of precision marching by guardsmen in red uniforms, accompanied by glittering brass bands, be in London for the Trooping of the Colour. This ceremony takes place on or near the Queen's official birthday, usually the second Saturday in June. In golf, the Open Championship happens in July. Its location varies, though it's often at one of the superb links courses around Liverpool, such as Lytham St. Annes. Best of all the courses is St. Andrews in eastern Scotland, where, according to tradition, the game began. The course is famously challenging, even to the world's best players, and includes such features as a set of pot bunkers so deep it's virtually impossible to hit out of them once you're in. The Yorkshire Three Peaks Challenge includes several annual charity events, requiring you to walk 24 miles in one July day over three of the highest mountains in the county, Ingleborough, Wernside and Penny Ghent. I did it at the age of 55 and lived to tell the tale. All these events, along with the London Marathon, April, the Chelsea Flower Show, May, and the Farnborough Air Show, July, happen just once each year. But the internet makes finding when and where easier than ever before. I won't go into detail about particular hotels or restaurants, because such things depend entirely on your budget and on the amount of time you want to spend relaxing rather than being out and about. But let me mention a couple of general points about food. First, Britain, through most of the 20th century, had a reputation for bad food, which was at least partially justified. The arrival of a large immigrant community from India and Pakistan in the 1950s and 60s led to a change for the better. By now, the nation as a whole, and not just London, is full of Indian, Chinese, French and Italian restaurants, whose collective effect has been to widen British tastes. Even at the bottom of the market, things are better, because McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken have displaced the old British hamburger chain, Wimpy, which was indescribably awful. Bed and breakfast guest houses, of which there are thousands, usually offer the full English breakfast, which consists of fried bacon, fried sausages, fried tomatoes, fried mushrooms, fried eggs, and a handy slice of fried bread, something you've probably never eaten before. Note the major adjective there. It's a heart-stopping prospect for people who are not used to it. On the other hand, it's extremely tasty and sets you up for a day of vigorous tourism. In Wales, it's called the full Welsh breakfast. In Scotland, it's called the full Scottish breakfast and comes with black pudding thrown in as well. Think carefully about how you're going to get around. In London, the underground, or tube, is by far the most effective method. It's a dense system that can take you to every site you want to visit, and the trains are frequent, clean, and efficient. By contrast, the buses and taxis are susceptible to frequent delays, because there's far more traffic than the roads can manage. For the last couple of decades, an Inner London Congestion Charge has been levied on vehicles entering the capital's central area. It was designed to discourage traffic by being punitively expensive. That helps, but jams are still common. So, walk or take the tube. If you're adventurous, rent one of the bikes that you can now find ready to hand at almost every street corner. Elsewhere in Britain, it's worth having a rental car, especially if you plan to visit rural sites like Stonehenge, Hadrian's Wall, and the Pennine Hills, which are inaccessible by train. Driving on the left takes concentration, especially on the first couple of days. You'll find, however, that you get used to it relatively quickly, because the whole system is set up to support drivers who are on the left. The steering wheel is on what at first feels like the wrong side, which itself helps focus your attention. The fact that everyone else is driving on the left means that you simply have to fall in with the crowd. Roundabouts, much more efficient than traffic lights, also take a little getting used to if you haven't tried them before. The rule is that you give way to traffic coming in from the right. Once you're in the roundabout, you have priority over cars trying to enter it from your left. I found that the only really dangerous part of driving on the left rather than the right is when you set off first thing in the morning on an empty road. If no one else is around, it's easy to forget and to revert to behaviour that's become almost instinctual. This is one of those situations where spousal shouts of alarm should be welcomed, not deplored. Spend at least a little time in Britain with the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation. Now approaching its 100th birthday, it's a central element of British life. Where America decided from the start to pay for radio and television by advertising, Britain decided to have a state-run system paid for by licensing fees. Lord Reith, an early director of the BBC, took the view that education should be one of the main functions of broadcasting, as much or even more important than entertainment. That tradition has weakened in recent decades, as dozens of commercial stations have sprung up to compete with the BBC, but it's still not disappeared. Broadcasts of grand opera, documentaries on non-biodegradable mercury compounds, and an impossibly difficult quiz show, University Challenge, are regular features among its offerings. To watch the BBC's best shows over the course of a year is to give yourself a fairly thorough education and to enhance greatly your fund of general knowledge. BBC Radio has a variety of stations, but the one best geared to give you an insight into how the broad middle classes think is Radio 4. On its morning news show, stories come in from all over the world. Places whose names are never spoken on American broadcast news, such as Burkina Faso and East Timor, get plenty of attention here. Combative presenters interview members of parliament and even prime ministers, not in a servile and deferential tone, but with sharp, sceptical questions, and they won't be put off with bland, non-committal answers that dodge the point. They look down on everyone, especially elected officials, in the name of giving you the truth. The newspapers, by contrast, are dreadful, at least if you're interested in finding out what's actually happened. Highly partisan, they mix up reporting and editorialising, often in a sneering and contemptuous way. The so-called red-top papers, The Sun, The Daily Star and The Daily Mirror, cultivate ignorance and narrow-mindedness and top it off with softcore pornography and leering tales about politicians' and celebrities' sexual misconduct. They're home ground for the paparazzi and make the prospect of being well-known in Britain highly unattractive. The more high-toned papers are also deeply political, with The Guardian to the left of centre and The Daily Telegraph to the right. The Telegraph is famous for excellent obituaries, But they have the drawback that you always get to hear about fascinating people only when they've just died and it's too late to seek them out. The London Times, once famous for its flinty integrity, has been degraded in the hands of Rupert Murdoch and now lacks the dignity it used to display, though admittedly it's also a good deal less dull. To find out what's going on in the world while you're in the UK, listen to Radio 4, read The Economist, and browse the online version of the New York Times. You'll be aware of other contrasts in everyday life. One is the immense popularity of the National Health Service. It was introduced at the end of World War II, when studies of the population demonstrated high levels of sickness, feebleness, chronic ailments, bad but correctable vision, and poor dentistry. England used to be famous for bad teeth. The Labour government of Clement Attlee was eager to reward the generation that had fought the Nazis and do a better job of creating homes fit for heroes than its post-World War I predecessor. For millions of Britons, the possibility of going to the doctor when you were sick became a reality for the first time. Improvements in general levels of health soon followed, along with increases in longevity and life expectancy. For decades now, the National Health Service, or NHS, has been a political football, subjected to experiments to increase its efficiency and to diminish the long waiting times required for non-emergency care. Despite all the grumbling, however, it's been consistently valued and even venerated by most people. Conservative just as much as Labour governments would not think of abolishing it. They are equally amazed and horrified by the American situation, where large numbers of people have no health insurance and where costs have escalated to staggering heights. Wherever you go in Britain, you'll get more out of it if you know something about the place beforehand. There are many good general histories of Britain, offering you enough to get the shape of the whole story without the burden of too much detail. I would recommend Paul Johnson's The Offshore Islanders, which you can read over the course of a week by giving it a couple of hours each evening. Johnson was an ardent socialist in his early life, but changed his mind in the 1970s, turned to conservatism, and became a fan of Margaret Thatcher. He was a compulsively readable historian before this turn, and he remained so afterwards, with a great gift for the appropriate anecdote or the compelling biographical sketch. Here's Paul Johnson describing the long sequence of wars between France and England in the Middle Ages. Much of the history of England has been a conflict between xenophobia and avarice, with the latter usually, in the end, getting the upper hand. The irresistible force of the English desire for war meets the immovable object of their refusal to pay for it. The English love to inflict violence on foreigners. Happily, they love money more. This is the hammer and anvil which forged the structure of English political society. Robert Toombs's book, The English and Their History, may strike you as a trifle long at over 1,000 pages. On the other hand, there's a lot of ground to cover, and he does it incredibly well. Because Toombs's scholarly work is mainly on French history, he turned to this topic as a kind of brilliantly gifted outsider, offering a broad-minded perspective rather than a narrowly nationalistic one. Equally gifted and lively is David Starkey, historian and BBC personality. He's a specialist in the life and work of Henry VIII, but also made a popular TV show on the history of the monarchy. You can watch the whole thing on YouTube to get you in the mood for the journey. After grounding yourself in the history, turn to some of the authors whose work gives you the feeling of British life. Ever since the American Revolution, American writers have been surprising themselves by how much they enjoy being in Britain. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Washington Irving, James Fenimore Cooper, and Nathaniel Hawthorne all spent time in Britain and loved it. Hawthorne had a lucrative diplomatic position as American consul in Liverpool, because his friend Franklin Pierce had somehow clawed his way into the White House. Harriet Beecher Stowe had a super time in England and met Queen Victoria for tea. Henry James, the American novelist who became an English gentleman, loved to be surrounded by reminders of England's monarchy, hierarchical institutions, and its long unbroken past. In fact, those are almost exactly the qualities of British life that continue to act as a magnet for Americans, even though their ancestors fought a revolutionary war to get away from it. On a visit to Oxford in about 1900, Henry James went to All Souls College for lunch. All Souls is distinguished for having no undergraduates and for being the university's, and indeed the entire nation's, most exclusive intellectual centre. "I found it agreeable to reflect," he wrote, "that this delightful spot exists for the satisfaction of a small society of fellows who, having no dreary instruction to administer, no noisy hobbledehoys to govern, no obligations but toward their own culture, no care save for learning as learning and truth as truth, are presumably the happiest and most charming people in the world." Even when sailing on the River Thames in London, which was then one of the most polluted places in the country, James could not suppress a sigh of Anglophilia. "The river is almost black, and is covered with black barges. Above the black housetops, from among the far-stretching docks and basins, rises a dusky wilderness of masts. The little puffing steamer is dingy and gritty. It belches a sable cloud that keeps you company as you go. In this carboniferous shower, your companions, who belong chiefly, indeed, to the classes bereft of luster, assume an harmonious greyness, and the whole picture, glazed over with the glutinous London mist, becomes a masterly composition." English Hours, the book from which these passages are taken, is almost an unintentional self-parody, very rich in elaborate Jamesian phrases. A gem from the 1930s is Margaret Halsey's With Malice Towards Some, which won the National Book Award in 1938 and became a bestseller. In her mid-twenties, Halsey spent a year in southern England while her husband was an exchange professor at Exeter University. Her comments on British fatalism, bad dress sense and bad food, offset by praise for the dazzlingly beautiful landscape, are fresh, sharp and free of clichés. Looking around in church one morning, she decides that all the other women must have dressed by standing in front of their closets in pitch darkness and choosing garments at random without any notion of their size, shape, or combination of colours. Among more recent figures, I'm a fan of Bill Bryson, the Iowa-born journalist who spent much of his life writing affectionately about Britain. His 1995 book, Notes from a Small Island, is an entertaining travelogue about his adopted country and its curious habits and customs. Here's a sample. "There's something awfully exhilarating about riding on the top of a double-decker. You can see into upstairs windows and peer down on the tops of people's heads at bus stops. And when they come upstairs a moment later, you can look at them with a knowing look that says, 'I've just seen the top of your head.'" In 2003, pollsters discovered that the British themselves thought this book represented them and their country better than any other. In 2016, Bryson wrote a follow-up, The Road to Little Dribbling, giving vent to some of his irritations about what's wrong with contemporary Britain. He emphasizes poor urban planning and the astonishing spread of tattoos, but persisting in taking pleasure in the British way of life and its many eccentricities, for which he has an acute eye. By then, Bryson himself had become a significant figure in British life, chairing the Campaign to Protect Rural England, and becoming a commissioner for English Heritage, one of the two major organisations dedicated to preserving historical monuments. Simon Jenkins also deserves your sympathetic attention. A major figure in British journalism throughout his life, Jenkins was editor, for a while, of both the London Evening Standard and the London Times. You know you're in the presence of someone unusual when you see that among his books is one called England's 1,000 Best Churches, and another entitled Britain's 100 Best Railway Stations. What lovely books they both are. He can gaze at a building and see things in it that you're likely to miss until he's pointed them out. He even manages to avoid seeming repetitive with the churches, bringing to bear on them a deep knowledge of their historical and architectural particulars. He has a keen appreciation for preserving all that's most interesting in the British built environment. For a while, aptly, Jenkins was chairman of the National Trust, the most important of all Britain's heritage organisations, which preserves thousands of old houses and landscapes of historical interest, many of which we visited in this course. The National Trust was founded in 1895 at the instigation of Octavia Hill, a philanthropic lady who was dedicated to improving workers' housing and to protecting urban parks. The Trust gained official support by an Act of Parliament in 1907. It grew steadily through the early 20th century, helped for a while by an anonymous group of female enthusiasts known as Ferguson's Gang. Their leader was Peggy Pollard. She read a book by the architect Clough Williams Ellis entitled England and the Octopus. It was a lament about urban sprawl and government short-sightedness in land use. Pollard decided that she'd do something to improve the situation. An anonymous note she delivered to the National Trust included the following verse. "We ain't so many, we ain't so few. All of us has this end in view. National Trust, to work for you. Green grass turning to bricks and dust. Stately homes that will soon go bust. No defence but the National Trust. Looking at rural England thus, George and the Dragon is changed for us into St. Clough and the Octopus." She and her wealthy friends then set about buying houses and lands that were in danger of destruction and donating them anonymously. They were able to donate Shalford Mill in Surrey, the old town hall at Newtown on the Isle of Wight, a series of cliffs along the Cornish coast, and lands in Derbyshire and Oxfordshire that were threatened with suburban development. The National Trust was so impressed with their work that it invited the gang to speak on its behalf when the BBC offered it the chance to make a radio address in 1935. In the years after the Second World War, the Labour government of Clement Attlee imposed punitive death taxes on large landowners. The amount of money required from aristocratic families that hoped to retain their estates was so great that many decided to give up the struggle and hand their properties over to the National Trust, which they could do in lieu of payment. Trust employees were a mixture of highly practical men and women who knew about property management on the one hand, and architectural historians for whom aesthetics were all important on the other. They referred to each other as the boots and the lilies. Those landowners who resisted the National Trust were almost obliged to open their houses to the public in any case so as to raise sufficient revenue to keep pace with the tax gatherers. Chatsworth House in Derbyshire is a magnificent case in point, as are the Longleat House and Grounds in Wiltshire. As a result, the days of immense private estates from which ordinary people were excluded came to an end. A century's worth of economic pressure and spontaneous generosity from citizens both rich and poor has had the collective effect of making far more of Britain's heritage accessible to visitors than ever before. I'm sorry to say that we've now reached the end of our tour of Great Britain. For those of you who've never visited, I hope I've inspired you to start planning a trip. If you've been before, please go again. If you're already in Britain or are a frequent visitor, I hope you've learned more about it from this series. I'm aware, of course, that even 18 hours can do little more than scratch the surface, and that many of you will regret that I didn't have the chance to mention places or activities in Britain that you particularly cherish. Mention these places to me and to one another on the Great Courses webpage for this series. Let me close by thanking my many friends at the Great Courses who have, as usual, brought intelligence and creativity to bear on this series. and to Paul Meyer for adding the colourful regional voices. Thanks also to the relatives who contributed suggestions about where to go and many additional photographs. My brother Malcolm, sister Deborah, daughter Frances, brother-in-law Richard Langley, and possible future son-in-law Edward Spencer. No pressure, Ed. Also, a huge thank you to Mrs. Allett, the most widely read person I've ever met, and the loveliest, whose help, especially on the literary lectures, was indispensable. Above all, I'd like to thank my father, Eric Allett, who's 96 as I record these lectures, and who first introduced me to the richness and complexity of Britain and its heritage. The years of his lifetime, beginning in 1921, witnessed the transformation of Britain from world power to isolated island kingdom off the coast of an otherwise united Europe. In one sense, that's a fall in status. But the reality is one of greater wealth, higher productivity, an improved environment, greater democracy, a healthier and better educated population, and a range of opportunities that were unimaginable during his childhood. Britain has long been a very good place. Now it's better than ever.
We hope you have enjoyed these lectures from The Great Courses. Our courses are available online or via the free The Great Courses app for smartphones and tablets, available on the App Store or Google Play. View our full library at thegreatcourses.com. Or as always, you can call our customer care representatives at 1-800-832-2412. Thank you very much.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.